A horse colt, sorrel with a blaze, sort of crooked down his face, like this. Robert spoke slowly and softly, indicating the marking on the colt's forehead by outlining it with a finger on his own face. Tao realized then that as long as Josiah and Rocky had been alive, he had never known Robert except as a quiet man in the house that belonged to old Grandma and Auntie. When Auntie and old Grandma and Josiah used to argue over how many lambs should be sold, or when Auntie and old Grandma scolded Josiah for the scandal of his Mexican girlfriend, Robert sat quietly. He had cultivated this deafness for as many years as he had been married to Auntie. His face was calm. He was patient with them because he had nothing to say. The sheep, the horses, and the fields, everything belonged to them, including the good family name. Now Robert had all the things that Josiah had been responsible for. He looked tired. "I help my brother-in-law with our fields, but they don't expect me to do very much now. They know I'm pretty busy over here."
"When I get better, I can help you."
Robert smiled and nodded. "That would be nice," he said softly. "But don't hurry. You take it easy. Get well."
He stood up. He was a short, slight man with a dark, angular face. He put his hand on Teo's arm.
"I'm glad you're home, Tao," he said. "I sure am glad."
He woke up crying. He had dreamed Josiah had been hugging him close the way he had when Tao was a child, and in the dream he smelled Josiah's smell, horses, wood smoke, and sweat, the smell he had forgotten until the dream, and he was overcome with all the love there was. He cried because he had to wake up to what was left, the dim room, empty beds, and a March dust storm rattling the tin on the roof. He lay there with the feeling that there was no place left for him. He would find no peace in that house where the silence and the emptiness echoed the loss. He wanted to go back to the hospital, right away. He had to get back where he could merge with the walls and the ceiling, shimmering white, remote from everything. He sat up and pushed off the blankets. He was sweating. He looked at old Grandma sitting in her place beside the stove. He couldn't tell if she was sleeping or if she was only listening to the wind with her eyes closed. His voice was shaking. He called her. He wanted to tell her that they had to take him back to the hospital. He watched her get up slowly. With old bones that were stems of thin glass, she shuffled across the linoleum in her cloth slippers, moving cautiously as if she didn't trust memory to take her to his bed. She sat down on the edge of the bed and she reached out for him. She held his head in her lap and she cried with him, saying, "Amo'u, Amo'u," over and over again. "I've been thinking," she said, wiping her eyes on the edge of her apron, "all this time while I was sitting in my chair. Those white doctors haven't helped you at all. Maybe we'd better send for somebody else." When Auntie got back from the store, old Grandma told her, "That boy needs a medicine man. Otherwise he'll have to go away. Look at him." Auntie was standing with a bag full of groceries in her arms. She set the bag down on the table and took off her coat and bandana. She looked at Tao. She had a way she looked when she saw trouble. She frowned, getting her answer ready for the old lady. "Oh, I don't know, Mama. You know how they are. You know what people will say if we ask for a medicine man to help him. Someone will say it's not right. They'll say, 'Don't do it. He's not full blood anyway.'" She hung up her coat and draped the scarf on top of it. "It'll start all over again, all that gossip about Josiah and about little sister. Girls around here have babies by white men all the time now. Nobody says anything. Men run around with Mexicans, and even worse, and nothing is ever said. Just let it happen with our family." Old Grandma interrupted her the way she always did whenever Auntie got started on that subject. "He's my grandson. If I send for old Koosh, he'll come. Let them talk if they want to. Why do you care what they say? Let them talk. By planting time, they'll forget." Old Grandma stood up straight when she said this and stared at Auntie with milky cataract eyes. You know what the army doctor said? No Indian medicine. Old Koosh will bring his bag of weeds and dust. Doctor won't like it. But her tone of voice was one of temporary defeat, and she was already thinking ahead to some possible satisfaction later on, when something went wrong and it could be traced back to this decision. Like the night she tried to tell them not to keep the little boy for sis anymore. By then, she was even running around with colored men, and she was always drunk. She came that night to leave the little boy with them. They could have refused then. They could have told her then not to come around anymore. But they didn't listen to her then, either. Later on, they saw, and she used to say to them, "See, I tried to tell you." But they didn't care, her brother Josiah and her mother. They didn't care what the people were saying about their family, or that the village officers had a meeting one time and talked about running Sis off the reservation for good. Old Grandma pulled the chair from the foot of the bed, and the old man sat down. He nodded at Teo, but didn't say anything. Teo didn't understand what he was waiting for until he saw old Grandma wearing her coat and wool scarf, waiting while Auntie put on her coat. They left, and old Koosh waited until the voices of the women could no longer be heard before he moved the chair closer to the bed. He smelled like mutton tallow and mountain sagebrush. He spoke softly, using the old dialect full of sentences that were involuted with explanations of their own origins, as if nothing the old man said were his own, but all had been said before, and he was only there to repeat it. Teo had to strain to catch the meaning, dense with place names he had never heard. His language was childish, interspersed with English words, and he could feel shame tightening in his throat. But then he heard the old man describe the cave, a deep lava cave northeast of Laguna, where bats flew out on summer evenings. He pushed himself up against the pillows and felt the iron bed frame against his back. He knew this cave. The rattlesnakes liked to lie there in the early spring when the days were still cool and the sun warmed the black lava rock first. The snakes went there to restore life to themselves. The old man gestured to the northeast, and Teo turned his head that way and remembered the wide, round hole, so deep that even lying on his belly beside Rocky, he had never been able to see bottom. He remembered the small rocks they had nudged over the edge, and how they had listened for some sound when the rocks hit bottom. But the cave was deeper than the sound. Auntie told them she would whip them if they didn't stay away from that place, because there were snakes around there and they might fall in. But they went anyway, on summer nights after supper, when the crickets smelled the coolness and started singing. They were careful of the snakes that came out hunting after sundown, and they sneaked up to the cave very quietly and waited for the bats to fly out. He nodded to the old man because he knew this place. People said back in the old days they took scalps and threw them down there. Teo knew what the old man had come for. Koosh continued slowly, in a soft chanting voice, saying, "Maybe you don't know some of these things," vaguely acknowledging the distant circumstance of an absent white father. He called Josiah by his Indian name and said, "If he had known then, maybe he could have told you before you went to the white people's big war." He hesitated then and looked at Teo's eyes. "But you know, grandson, this world is fragile." The word he chose to express, fragile, was filled with the intricacies of a continuing process, and with a strength inherent in spider webs woven across paths through sand hills, where early in the morning sun becomes entangled in each filament of web. It took a long time to explain the fragility and intricacy because no word exists alone, and the reason for choosing each word had to be explained with a story about why it must be said this certain way. That was the responsibility that went with being human, old Koosh said. The story behind each word must be told, so there could be no mistake in the meaning of what had been said, and this demanded great patience and love. More than an hour went by before Koosh asked him. "You were with the others," he said. "The ones who went to the white people's war?" Teo nodded.
There is something they have sent me to ask you. Something maybe you need now that you are home.
Teo was listening to the wind outside. Late in the afternoon, it would begin to die down.
You understand, don't you? It's important to all of us, not only for your sake, but for this fragile world.
He didn't know how to explain what had happened. He didn't know how to tell him that he hadn't killed any enemy, or that he didn't think he had, but that he had done things far worse, and the effects were everywhere in the cloudless sky. On the dry brown hills, shrinking skin and hide, taut over sharp bone. The old man was waiting for him to answer. Teo reached down for the slop jar and pulled it closer. I'm sick, he said, turning away from the old man to vomit. I'm sick, but I never killed any enemy. I never even touched them. He was shivering and sweating when he sat up. Maybe you could help me anyway. Do something for me the way you did for the others who came back, because what if I didn't know I killed one? But the old man shook his head slowly and made a low humming sound in his throat. In the old way of warfare, you couldn't kill another human being in battle without knowing it, without seeing the result, because even a wounded deer that got up and ran again left great clots of lung blood or spilled guts on the ground. That way the hunter knew it would die. Human beings were no different. But the old man wouldn't have believed white warfare, killing across great distances without knowing who or how many had died. It was all too alien to comprehend, the mortars and big guns. And even if he could have taken the old man to see the target areas, even if he could have led him through the fallen jungle trees and muddy craters of torn earth to show him the dead, the old man wouldn't have believed anything so monstrous. Kuush would have looked at the dismembered corpses and the atomic heat flash outlines where human bodies had evaporated, and the old man would have said something close and terrible had killed these people. Not even old-time witches killed like that. The way I heard it was in the old days, long time ago, they had this scalp society for warriors who killed or touched dead enemies. They had things they must do. Otherwise, Kuuko would haunt their dreams with her great fangs, and everything would be endangered. Maybe the rain wouldn't come, or the deer would go away. That's why they had things they must do. The flute, and dancing, blue cornmeal, and hair washing. All these things they had to do. The room was almost dark. Teo wondered where Auntie and old Grandma had been all this time. The old man put his sack on his lap and began to feel around inside it with both hands. He brought out a bundle of dry green stalks and a small paper bag full of blue cornmeal. He laid the bundle of Indian tea in Teo's lap. He stood up then and set the bag of cornmeal on the chair.
There are some things we can't cure like we used to, he said. Not since the white people came. The others who had the scalp ceremony, some of them are not better either.
He pulled a blue wool cap over his ears.
I'm afraid of what will happen to all of us if you and the others don't get well, he said.
Old man Kuush left that day, and as soon as he had closed the door, Teo rolled over on his belly and knocked the stalks of Indian tea on the floor. He pressed his face into the pillow and pushed his head hard against the bed frame. He cried, trying to release the great pressure that was swelling inside his chest, but he got no relief from crying anymore. The pain was solid and constant as the beating of his own heart. The old man only made him certain of something he had feared all along, something in the old stories. It took only one person to tear away the delicate strands of the web, spilling the rays of sun into the sand, and the fragile world would be injured. Once there had been a man who cursed the rain clouds, a man of monstrous dreams. Teo screamed and curled his body against the pane. Auntie woke him and gave him a cup of Indian tea brewed dark as coffee. It was late, and they had already eaten supper. Robert was sitting at the kitchen table, saddle-soaping a bridle. Old Grandma was dozing beside her stove. The tea was mild, tasting like the air after a rainstorm, when all the grass and plants smell green and the earth is damp. She brought him a bowl of blue cornmeal mush. He shook his head when he looked at it, but she sat down on the chair by the bed and fed him spoonful by spoonful. He looked at her while she fed him. He knew she had asked Ku'ush not to mention the visit, except to the old men. He knew she was afraid people would find out he was crazy. The cornmeal mush tasted sweet. His stomach didn't cramp around it like it did with other food. She took the empty bowl and cup away. He slid down under the blankets and waited for the nausea to come. If this didn't work, then he knew he would die. He let himself go limp. He didn't brace himself against the nausea. He didn't care anymore if it came. He didn't care anymore if he died. He was sitting in the sun outside the screen door when they came driving into the yard. He had been looking at the apple tree by the woodshed, trying to see the tiny green fruits that would grow all summer until they became apples. He'd been thinking about how easy it was to stay alive now that he didn't care about being alive anymore. The tiny apples hung on that way. They didn't seem to fall, even in strong wind. He could eat regular food. He seldom vomited anymore. Some nights he even slept all night without the dreams. He went with them in the old Ford coupe. He laid his head back on the dusty seat and felt the sun getting hot on his shoulders and neck. He didn't listen to them while they laughed and talked about how Emo bought the car. He didn't hear where they said they were going. He didn't care. It was already getting hot, and it was still springtime. The sky was empty. The sun was too hot, and it made the color of the sky too pale blue. He was the last one through the screen door at Dixie Tavern. Harley pushed a bottle of beer in front of him. Harley said something to Teo, and the others all laughed. These good times were courtesy of the U.S. government in the Second World War. Cash from disability checks earned, with shrapnel in the neck at Wake Island, or shell shock on Iwo Jima. Rewards for surviving the Bataan Death March. Hey, Teo, you cash your check yet? Teo pushed a $10 bill across the table. More beer, he said. Emo was getting drunk on whiskey. His face was flushed and his forehead sweaty. Teo watched Harley and Leroy flip quarters to see who was buying the next round, and he swallowed the beer in big mouthfuls like medicine. He could feel something loosening up inside. He had heard Auntie talk about the veterans. Drunk all the time, she said. But he knew why. It was something the old people couldn't understand. Liquor was medicine for the anger that made them hurt, for the pain of the loss. Medicine for tight bellies and choked-up throats. He was beginning to feel a comfortable place inside himself, close to his own beating heart, near his own warm belly. He crawled inside and watched the storm swirling on the outside, and he was safe there. The winds of rage couldn't touch him. They were all drunk now, and they wanted him to talk to them. They wanted him to tell stories with them. Someone kept patting him on the back. He reached for another bottle of beer. White women never looked at me till I put on that uniform, and then, by God, I was a U.S. Marine, and they came crowding around. All during the war, they say to me, "Hey, soldier, you sure are handsome, all that black, thick hair." "Dance with me," the blonde girl said. "You know, Los Angeles was the biggest city I ever saw. All those streets and tall buildings. Lights at night everywhere. I never saw so many bars and jukeboxes. All the people coming from everywhere, dancing and laughing. They never asked me if I was Indian. Sold me as much beer as I could drink. I was a big spender then. Had my military pay. Double starch in my uniform and my boots shining so good. I mean, those white women fought over me. Yeah, they did, really. I went home with a blonde one time. She had a big 38 Buick. Good car. She let me drive it all the way. Hey, whose turn to buy?" The first day in Oakland, he and Rocky walked down the street together, and a big Chrysler stopped in the street, and an old white woman rolled down the window and said, "God bless you." God bless you. But it was the uniform, not them, she blessed.
Come on, Teo, they didn't keep you on latrine duty the whole war, did they? You talk now. Yeah, come on!
Someone jerked the bottle out of his hand. His hand was cold and wet. He clenched it into a fist. They were outside him in the distance. His own voice sounded far away, too.
America, America, he sang. God shed his grace on thee.
He stopped and pulled a beer away from Harley.
One time there were these Indians, see? They put on uniforms, cut their hair. They went off to a big war. Had a real good time, too. Bars served them booze. Old white ladies on the street smiled at them. And Indians, remember that, because that's all they were, Indians. These Indians fucked white women. They had as much as they wanted, too. They were MacArthur's boys. White whores took their money same as anyone. These Indians got treated the same as anyone. Wake Island, Iwo Jima, they got the same medals for bravery, same flag over the coffin.
Teo stopped. He realized the others weren't laughing and talking anymore. They were listening to him, and they weren't smiling. He took another beer from Harley's hand and swallowed until the bottle was empty. Harley yelled, "Hey, Manny!" to the bartender. "Plug in the jukebox for us!" But Teo yelled, "No! No, I didn't finish this story yet. See, these dumb Indians thought these good times would last. They didn't ever want to give up the cold beer and the blonde cunt. Hell no. They were America the Beautiful, too. This was the land of the free, just like teachers said in school. They had the uniform, and they didn't look different no more. They got respect." He could feel the words coming out faster and faster, the momentum building inside him like the words were all going to explode, and he wanted to finish before it happened.
"I'm half-breed. I'll be the first to say it. I'll speak for both sides. First time you walked down the street in Gallup or Albuquerque, you knew. No lie, you knew right away. The war was over, the uniform was gone, all of a sudden that man at the store waits on you last. Makes you wait until all the white people bought what they wanted. And the white lady at the bus depot, she's real careful now not to touch your hand when she counts out your change. You watch it slide across the counter at you, and you know. God damn it, you stupid son of a bitches, you know!"
The bartender came over. He was a fat Mexican from Cubero who was losing his hair. He looked at them nervously. Harley and Leroy were holding Teo's arms gently. They said something to the bartender, and he went away. The jukebox lit up, and Hank Williams started singing. Teo got quiet. He looked across at Emo, and he saw how much Emo hated him, because he had spoiled it for them. They spent all their checks trying to get back the good times, and a skinny, light-skinned bastard had ruined it. That's what Emo was thinking. Here they were, trying to bring back that old feeling, that feeling they belonged to America the way they felt during the war. They blamed themselves for losing the new feeling. They never talked about it, but they blamed themselves just like they blamed themselves for losing the land the white people took. They never thought to blame white people for any of it. They wanted white people for their friends. They never saw that it was the white people who gave them that feeling, and it was white people who took it away again when the war was over. Belonging was drinking and laughing with the platoon, dancing with blonde women, buying drinks for buddies born in Cleveland, Ohio. Teo knew what they had been trying to do. They repeated the stories about good times in Oakland and San Diego. They repeated them like long medicine chants, the beer bottles pounding on the countertops like drums. Another round and Harley tells his story about two blondes in bed with him. They forget Teo's story. They give him another beer. Two bottles in front of him now. They go on with it, but they're good old times. Teo starts crying. They think maybe he's crying about what the Japs did to Rocky, because they're to that part of the ritual where they damn those yellow Jap bastards. Someone pats Teo on the back. Harley wants to comfort him. They don't know he's crying for them. They don't know that he doesn't hate the Japanese, not even the Japanese soldiers who were grim-faced watching Teo and the corporal stumble with the stretcher. The short one had stopped and looked at Rocky in the blanket. He called the tall one over. The tall one looked like a Navajo guy from Fort Defiance that Teo had known at Indian school. They looked tired, too, those Japanese soldiers, like they wanted this march to be over, too. That tall one, he even shook his head like Willie Begay did. Two abrupt movements, almost too quick to see. And then he pulled the corporal to his feet. But when Teo tried to give the corporal his end of the blanket again, the tall soldier pushed Teo away, not hard, but the way a small child would be pushed away by an older brother. It was then Teo got confused, and he called this tall Jap soldier Willie Begay. "You remember him, Willie? He's my brother. Best football player Albuquerque Indian School ever had." The tall soldier looked at him curiously. He pushed Teo out of the way into the ditch, running full of muddy water. He pulled the blanket over Rocky as if he were already dead, and then he jabbed the rifle butt into the muddy blanket. Teo never heard the sound because he was screaming. Later on, he regretted that he hadn't listened, because it became an uncertainty, loose inside his head, wandering into his imagination, so that any hollow, crushing sound he heard, children smashing gourds along the irrigation ditch, or a truck tire running over a piece of dry wood, any of these sounds took him back to that moment. Screaming with mud in his mouth and in his eyes, screaming until the others dragged him away before the Japs killed him too. He fought them, trying to lie down in the ditch beside the blanket already partially buried in the mud. He had never planned to go any farther than Rocky went. They tried to help him. The corporal who had helped carry Rocky for so long put his arm around Teo and kept him on his feet. "Easy, easy, it's okay, don't cry. Your brother was already dead. I heard him say it, Jap talk for dead. He was already gone anyway. There was nothing anyone could do." At the prison camp, behind the barbed wire, enclosed in many more layers of barbed wire, Teo thought he saw the tall soldier come each day to stand beside the guard at the south fence and stare for a long time in his direction. But the soldier was too far away, and the fever was too severe for Teo to be sure of anything he had seen. "How's your sunstroke?" Harley said when he saw that Teo was awake. Harley had a handful of wild grapes, not much bigger than blueberries. He reached over and gave Teo some. The leaves were small and dark green. Teo looked up at the big orange sand rock where the wild grapevine grew out of the sand and climbed along a fissure in the face of the boulder. Harley picked some more. He ate them in big mouthfuls, chewing the seeds because most of the grape was seed anyway. Teo couldn't bite down on the seeds. Once he had loved to feel them break between his teeth, but not anymore. The sound of crushing made him sick. He got up and walked the sandy trail to the spring. He didn't want to hear Harley crush the seeds. The canyon was the way he always remembered it. The bee-weed plants made the air smell heavy and sweet like wild honey, and the bumblebees were buzzing around waxy yucca flowers. The leaves of the cottonwood trees that crowded the canyon caught reflections of the afternoon sun, hundreds of tiny mirrors flashing. He blinked his eyes and looked away to the shade below the cliffs where the rabbit brush was green and yellow daisies were blooming. The people said that even in the driest years, nobody could ever remember a time when the spring had dried up. Josiah had told him about the spring while they waited for the water barrels to fill. He'd been sitting on the wagon seat, taken from a 23 Chrysler that wrecked near Parahe. And after all those years, the springs poked through the faded mouse fur fabric like devil claws. Teo used to stand in the big sandstone cave and hold the siphon hose under the water in the shallow pool, where the spring water splashed down from the west wall of the cave. The water was always cold, icy cold, even in the summer, and Teo liked the way it felt when he was sweating and took off his shirt. The splashing water made an icy mist that almost disappeared before it touched him. "You see," Josiah had said, with the sound of the water trickling out of the hose into the empty wooden barrel, "there are some things worth more than money." He pointed his chin at the springs and around at the narrow canyon. "This is where we come from, see? This sand, this stone, these trees, the vines, all the wildflowers. This earth keeps us going." He took off his hat and wiped his forehead on his shirt. "These dry years, you hear some people complaining, you know, about the dust and the wind and how dry it is. But the wind and the dust, they're part of life too, like the sun and the sky. You don't swear at them. It's people, see? They're the ones. The old people used to say that droughts happen when people forget, when people misbehave." Teo knelt on the edge of the pool and let the dampness soak into the knees of his jeans. He closed his eyes and swallowed the water slowly. He tasted the deep heart rock of the earth, where the water came from, and he thought maybe this wasn't the end after all. One time, old woman Kuko's son came in from Red Leaf Town up north. His name was Pakanyanyi, and he didn't know who his father was. He asked the people, "You people want to learn some magic?" And the people said, "Yes, we can always use some." Mausui and Uyeyui, the twin brothers, were caring for the mother corn altar, but they got interested in this magic too. "What kind of medicine man are you anyway?" they asked him. "A Kokoyo medicine man," he said. "Tonight we'll see if you really have magical power," they told him. So that night, Pakanyanyi came with his mountain lion. He undressed, he painted his body, the worlds of flesh, the soles of his feet, the palms of his hands, the top of his head. He wore feathers on each side of his head. He made an altar with cactus spines and purple loco weed flowers. He lighted four cactus torches at each corner. He made the mountain lion lie down in front, and then he was ready for his magic. He struck the middle of the north wall. He took a piece of flint and he struck the middle of the north wall. Water poured out of the wall and flowed down toward the south. He said, "What does that look like? Is that magic power?" He struck the middle of the west wall, and from the east wall a bear came out. "What do you call this?" he said again. "Yes, it looks like magic, all right," Mausui said. So it was finished, and Mausui and Uyeyui and all the people were fooled by that Kokoyo medicine man, Pakanyanyi. From that time on, they were so busy playing around with that Kokoyo magic, they neglected the mother corn altar. They thought they didn't have to worry about anything. They thought this magic could give life to plants and animals. They didn't know it was all just a trick. Our mother, Nautsi'i, was very angry over this, over the way all of them, even Mausui and Uyeyui, fooled around with this magic. "I've had enough of that," she said. "If they like that magic so much, let them live off it." So she took the plants and grass from them. No baby animals were born. She took the rain clouds with her. Harley's burrow went faster after they left the spring, and the gray mule had to walk faster to keep slack in the rope. The sun was moving toward the west. Teo squinted, trying to find some clouds on the west horizon. He wished then they had taught him more about the clouds and the sky, about the way the priests called the storm clouds to bring the rain. Teo watched the sun for a long time, and at the Akoma Road they stopped and he watched it disappear behind the hills in the west. Harley was looking down the road with his head turned slightly to the side, listening to something. "I think I hear a car."
"Yeah. Okay, Teo."
Harley's voice was excited.
"If they stop for us, let's leave the burrow and the mule here. There's a windmill over there. We can come back and get them later on."
Harley was already untying the rope around the burrow's neck to use for a hobble. Theo could see the outline of a car coming from a coma. It had an umbrella of road dust above it. Harley stood on the side of the road and started waving his arms to flag it down.
"Tuesday nights are slow," the bartender said.
Harley finished his second beer and joked with the bartender about how far they had come just for cold beer. Theo held on to the beer bottle, feeling moisture condense on his fingers. The bar didn't change. Whatever the color of the walls, they were always dirty. Dark grime of stale beer and cigarette smoke. It always smelled the same, too. A lingering odor of urine and vomit. Even the light bulb above the pool table shined dim, soiled light. He was glad he noticed it now, before he drank the beer. He had seen the color of that light once before, but he'd never been sure if it was the light or the beer he was drinking. He drank the beer slowly and waited to feel it spread from his belly, warming him all over. He finished the bottle and leaned back in the chair. He wanted to remember Rocky's face again and to think of them together. Rocky was standing in a small clearing surrounded by thickets of scrub oak. It was still early in the fall, and only a few of the coppery yellow leaves had fallen from the oaks. Theo had to strain to see the deer in the tall yellow grass. He crossed a narrow, dry gully, and then he could see the antlers. He approached the deer slowly. It had fallen on its right side, with its forelegs tucked under its belly. The hind legs were curled under to the left, as if it were still sleeping in the grass. The eyes were still liquid and golden brown, staring at the dark mountain dirt and dry oak leaves tangled in the grass. When he was a little child, he always wanted to pet a deer, and he daydreamed that a deer would let him come close and touch its nose. He knelt and touched the nose. It was softer than pussy willows and cattails, and still warm as a breath. The bright blood in the nostrils was still wet. He touched the big mule-sized ears, and they were still warm. He knew it wouldn't last long. The eyes would begin to cloud and turn glassy green, then gray, sinking back in the skull. The nose would harden, and the ears would get stiff. But for that moment, it was so beautiful that he could only stand and feel the presence of the deer. He knew what they said about deer was true. Rocky was honing his knife. He tested the blade on a thread hanging from the sleeve of his jacket. The sun was settling down in the southwest sky above the Twin Peaks. It would be dark in an hour or so. Rocky rolled the carcass belly up and spread open the hind legs. When Theo saw he was getting started, he looked at the eyes again. He took off his jacket and covered the deer's head. "Why did you do that?" asked Rocky, motioning at the jacket with the blade of his knife. Long gray hairs were matted into the blood on the blade. Theo didn't say anything because they both knew why. The people said you should do that before you gutted the deer, out of respect. But Rocky was funny about those things. He was an A student in all-state in football and track. He had to win. He said he was always going to win. So he listened to his teachers and he listened to the coach. They were proud of him. They told him, "Nothing can stop you now except one thing. Don't let the people at home hold you back." Rocky understood what he had to do to win in the white outside world. After their first year at boarding school in Albuquerque, Theo saw how Rocky deliberately avoided the old-time ways. Old Grandma shook her head at him, but he called it superstition, and he opened his textbooks to show her. But Auntie never scolded him. And she never let Robert or Josiah talk to him either. She wanted him to be a success. She could see what white people wanted in an Indian, and she believed this way was his only chance. She saw it as her only chance, too, after all the village gossip about their family. When Rocky was a success, no one would dare to say anything against them anymore. Rocky slit the throat. Blood spilled over the grass and into the dirt. It splashed on his boots. He didn't believe in drinking the warm blood, as some hunters did. Theo held a hind leg. It was beginning to get stiff. Rocky cut off the musk glands and testicles. He slit the belly open carefully to avoid spilling the contents of the stomach. The body heat made steam in the cold air. The sun was down, and the twilight chill sucked the last of the deer's life away. The eyes were dull and sunken. It was gone. Josiah and Robert came then and unloaded their rifles and leaned them against a scrub oak. They went to the deer and lifted the jacket. They knelt down and took pinches of cornmeal from Josiah's leather pouch. They sprinkled the cornmeal on the nose and fed the deer's spirit. They had to show their love and respect, their appreciation. Otherwise, the deer would be offended, and they wouldn't come to die for them the following year. Rocky turned away from them and poured water from the canteen over his bloody hands. He was embarrassed at what they did. He knew when they took the deer home it would be laid out on a Navajo blanket, and old Grandma would put a string of turquoise around its neck and put silver and turquoise rings around the tips of the antlers. Josiah would prepare a little bowl of cornmeal and place it by the deer's head so that anyone who went near could leave some on the nose. Rocky tried to tell them that keeping the carcass on the floor in a warm room was bad for the meat. He wanted to hang the deer in the woodshed, where the meat would stay cold and cure properly. But he knew how they were. All the people, even the Catholics that went to Mass every Sunday, followed the ritual of the deer. So he didn't say anything about it, but he avoided the room where they laid the deer. They marked the place with Teo's T-shirt spread across the top of some scrub oaks. It was getting dark when they started hiking back to the truck. Teo wrapped the liver and heart in the clean cheesecloth Josiah carried with him. An early winter moon was rising in front of them, and a chill wind came with it, penetrating feet and hands. Teo held the bundle tighter. He felt humbled by the size of the full moon, by the chill wind that swept wide across the foothills of the mountain. They said the deer gave itself to them because it loved them, and he could feel the love as the fading heat of the deer's body warmed his hands. Harley slid another bottle of Coors across the table to him and said, "Hey, man, we didn't come here to stare at the walls. We can do that any time. We need some music." He walked over to the jukebox. "Something to get us happy right now." Harley was a little nervous. He remembered the time Teo went crazy in the bar and almost killed Emo. He remembered how Teo had sat staring at the wall, not saying anything all afternoon while the rest of them had been laughing and drinking beer and telling army stories. Harley told the others not to bother him, but they were drunk and they kept after him. Finally, Teo jumped up and broke a beer bottle against the table, and before they could stop him, he shoved the jagged glass into Emo's belly. Teo smiled and looked over at Harley. "I won't push any broken bottle into your belly, Harley. Your belly's too big anyway." Harley laughed. "You sure scared us that time, man. Skinny as you are, it took three guys to pull you off him." "You know what they say, Harley. Crazy people are extra strong." Harley shook his head. He was serious. "No, Teo, you weren't crazy. You were just drunk." They all had different explanations for the attack. Emo claimed they never got along, not since grade school when they had rock fights in the schoolyard. He said Teo had wanted to get even with him for a long time. They all had explanations. The police, the doctors at the psychiatric ward, even Auntie and old Grandma. They blamed liquor, and they blamed the war. Reports note that since the Second World War, a pattern of drinking and violence not previously seen before is emerging among Indian veterans. But Teo shook his head when the doctor finished reading the report. "No," the doctor said in a loud voice. "It's more than that. I can feel it. It's been going on for a long time." "What do you think it is?" "I don't know what it is, but I can feel it all around me." "Is that why you're trying to kill Emo?" "Emo was asking for it." The wind stirred the dust. The people were starving. "She's angry with us," the people said. "Maybe because of that Kokoyo magic we were fooling with. We better send someone to ask our forgiveness." They noticed Hummingbird was fat and shiny, He had plenty to eat. They asked how come he looked so good. He said, down below, three worlds below this one, everything is green. All the plants are growing, the flowers are blooming. I go down there and eat.
You were real lucky, man, real lucky. You could have gone to jail, but they just sent you to the hospital again. If it had been me, I'd probably still be sitting in jail.
Harley's words were becoming disjointed, and he was accenting the words at the beginning and swallowing the ending sounds until it didn't sound like English anymore. He had another beer, and then he was rambling on to himself in Laguna. Emo rattled the Bull Durham sack. He bounced it in the palm of one hand and then the other. He took another swallow of whiskey. He had to have two or three swallows of whiskey before he'd talk. He took out the little cloth sack when he was ready.
You know, he said, slurring the words, us Indians deserve something better than this goddamn dried-up country around here, blown away every day.
He laughed at the rhyme he made. The other guys laughed, too, because Emo was mean when he was drinking.
What we need is what they got. I'll take San Diego.
He laughed, and they all laughed loudly. He threw the bag up in the air and caught it, confident of his audience. He didn't see Teo sitting back in the corner, leaning back in the chair with his eyes closed. He didn't know that Teo was clenching all his muscles against their voices. He didn't know that Teo was sweating, trying to fight off the nausea that surged at him whenever he heard the rattle in the little bag.
We fought their war for them. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we did. But they've got everything, and we don't got shit, do we? Huh?
They all shouted, hell no, loudly, and they drank the beer faster. And Emo raised the bottle, not bothering to pour the whiskey into the little glass anymore.
They took our land, they took everything. So let's get our hands on white women.
They cheered. Harley and Leroy were grinning and slapping each other on the back. Harley looked over at Teo, who was reading the label on the beer bottle. Coors Beer, brewed from pure Rocky Mountain spring water. Adolf Coors Company, Golden, Colorado. He looked at the picture of a cascading spring on the bottle. He didn't know of any springs that big anywhere. Did they ever have droughts in Colorado? Maybe Emo was wrong. Maybe white people didn't have everything. Only Indians had droughts. He finished off the beer. Harley was watching him and gave him another one. He couldn't hear the rattling in the little bag anymore, but he could still see Emo playing with it. He was thirsty, deep down somewhere behind his belly, near his heart. He drank the beer as if it were the tumbling ice-cold stream in the mountain canyon on the beer label. He kept drinking it, and Harley kept shoving the bottles across the table at him. Attention shifted from Emo to Teo.
Hey, look at him! No wonder he doesn't say anything. How many does that make?
Harley counted the empty bottles. He said something, but it was difficult for Teo to hear clearly. Their voices sounded dim and far away. He got up and weaved his way between the chairs and tables to the toilet at the back of the room. The yellow-stained walls were at the far end of the long tunnel between him and the world. He reached out across this distance to try to steady himself against the walls. He looked down at the stream of urine. It wasn't yellow, but clear like water. He imagined then that if a man could bring the drought, he could also return the water, out of his own belly, out of his own body. He strained the muscles of his belly and forced it out. He pushed down on the handle of the toilet, but it didn't flush. The lid of the toilet tank was leaning against the wall, and the floor was covered with dirty water. It was soaking through his boots. The sensation was sudden and terrifying. He couldn't get out of the room, and he was afraid he would fall into the stinking dirty water and have to crawl through it, like before, with jungle clouds raining down filthy water that smelled ripe with death. He lunged at the door. He landed on his hands and knees in the dark, outside the toilet. The dreams didn't wait any more for night. They came out any time. When he got back to the table, he saw that Emo's glasses were sitting crookedly on his puffy face. Emo watched him walk across the room to the table.
There he is.
He thinks he's something, all right, because he's part white.
Don't you, half-breed?
Teo stopped in front of them. He saw all their faces clustered around Emo's fat, sweaty head. He thought of dogs standing over something dead, crowded close together. He couldn't make out Harley or Leroy or Pinky. All he could see was Emo's sullen face. He stood there in front of them for a long time until his eyes lost focus. Someone touched his arm.
"Come on, Teo, sit down with us," Leroy said.
He put his mouth close to Teo's ear.
"Emo didn't mean nothing. He's just drunk, that's all."
Teo sat down. He knew Emo meant what he said. Emo had hated him since the time they had been in grade school together, and the only reason for this hate was that Teo was part white. But Teo was used to it by now. Since he could remember, he had known Auntie's shame for what his mother had done, and Auntie's shame for him. He remembered how the white men who were building the new highway through Laguna had pointed at him. They had elbowed each other and winked. He never forgot that. And finally, years later, he understood what it was about white men and Indian women. The disgrace of Indian women who went with them. And during the war, Teo learned about white women and Indian men. "We went into this bar on 4th Avenue, see? Me and O'Shea, this crazy Irishman. We had a few drinks. Then I saw these two white women sitting all alone. One was kind of fat. She had dark hair. But this other one, man, she had big tits and real blonde hair. I said to him, 'Hey, buddy, that's the one I want, over there.' He said, 'Go get him, chief.' He was my best drinking buddy, that guy. He'd watch me, see how good I'd score with each one. I'm Italian tonight."
"Oh, a wop!"
He laughed and hollered so loud, both those girls were watching us then. I smiled at both of them, see, so they'd both think I was friendly, but I gave my special look to the blonde, so she'd know, see? That's how I'd do it. Then I went up to the bar, and I told the bartender I wanted two more of whatever the ladies over there was drinking, and I went over. They took the drinks, and the fat one asked me to sit down. I sat down close to the blonde and told them my name. I used Matucci's name that night, his wop in our unit. The fat girl had a car. I sat in the middle, grabbing titties with both hands all the way to Long Beach. Next day, my buddy was dying to know. He kept asking all morning, "Well, well?" I told him, "Well, I scored all right." "Which one? Which one?" "Not one," I said. "Both of them." "Well, I'll be goddamned," he said. "All in the same bed?" "Yes, sir. This Indian was grabbing white pussy all night." "Shit, chief, that's some reputation you're making for Matucci." "Goddamn," I said. "Maybe next time I'll send him a bill."
Pinky was holding his belly, laughing so hard. Leroy and Harley were slapping each other on the backs, laughing real loud.
"Hey, Emo, that's a good one. Hey, tell the one about the time that guy told on you."
"Which guy?"
"When you were balling that little redhead and, what's his name, the Irishman? Yeah, he knocked on the door. You know, the Irishman knocked on the door and he yelled, 'Hey, Geronimo!'"
"Oh, yeah, that time."
Emo's forehead was covered with little balls of sweat. He wiped them off with the back of his hand. He was looking at Teo.
"Come on, Emo, tell it."
"I don't feel like it."
The corners of his mouth looked sullen.
"It's so damn funny. That white guy yells, 'Hey, Geronimo,' and the white woman hears him and says, 'Who's that?' He says, 'A drunk Irishman.' She says, 'No, who's that Geronimo?' You have a titty in your mouth so you don't answer. And she says, 'That's an Indian, isn't it?' And she yells back at him, 'This guy's an Indian?' He says, 'Yeah, his name is Geronimo.'
She starts screaming and faints.
Passed out.
Well, anyway, she fainted or passed out.
Leroy and Pinky finished the story and went for more beer. There was something about the story Emo didn't like. Teo was watching him. He didn't turn his eyes away when Emo looked back at him. They sat staring at each other across the big round table. Teo remembered fighting tomcats then. The frozen pose, arched bodies coiled, only the tails twitching with their anger, until one or the other made a move and they went rolling around in the dirt.
You don't like my stories, do you? Not good enough for you, huh? You think you're hot shit like your cousin. Big football star, big hero.
Emo pointed a finger at the empties in front of Teo.
One thing you can do is drink like an Indian, can't you? Maybe you aren't no better than the rest of us, huh?
Teo thought of Rocky then, and he was proud that Emo was so envious. The beer kept him loose inside. Emo's words never touched him. The beer stroked a place deep under his heart and put all the feeling to sleep. Then Emo took out the little bag again. He fumbled with the yellow pull strings and opened it. He poured the human teeth out on the table. He looked over at Teo and laughed out loud. He pushed them into circles and rows like unstrung beads. He scooped them into his hand and shook them like dice. They were his war souvenirs, the teeth he had knocked out of the corpse of a Japanese soldier. The night progressed according to that ritual. From cursing the barren dry land the white man had left them, to talking about San Diego and the cities where the white women were still waiting for them to come back to give them another taste of what white women never got enough of. But in the end, they always came around to it.
We were the best. U.S. Army. We butchered every Jap we found. No Jap bastard was fit to take prisoner. We had all kinds of ways to get information out of them before they died. Cut off this, cut off these.
Emo was grinning and hunched over, staring at the teeth.
Make them talk fast and die slow.
He laughed. Pinky and Harley laughed with him at his joke. Leroy came over for more money. Teo threw him a $20 bill. He was getting tense. He needed more beer to keep him loose inside and to make his stomach feel better. He swallowed some more. Every word Emo said pulled the knot in his belly tighter.
I only went after the officers. These teeth, they were from a Jap colonel, yeah.
Teo could hear it in his voice when he talked about the killing. How Emo grew from each killing. Emo fed off each man he killed. And the higher the rank of the dead man, the higher it made Emo.
We blew them all to hell. We should have dropped bombs and all the rest and blown them off the face of the earth.
He went into the old man's field to look at the melons, all round and full of slippery sinews of wet seeds. He raised his foot carefully and brought his boot down hard on the center of the melon. It made a popping sound. Seeds and wet pulp squirted out from the broken rind. They glistened with juice. He kicked the pieces and scattered them around the corn plants. He pulled one from its stem and held it in his hands. The skin was shiny and smooth, veined and mottled like green turquoise. He felt the shape. The symmetry of the oval pleased him. He raised it high over his head and smashed it against the ground. He made certain they were all gone. He looked back down the long row. Tiny black ants were scurrying over the shattered melons. The flies were rubbing their feet on fragments of pulp and rind. He trampled the ants with his boots, and he kicked dirt over the seeds and pulp. He watched flies buzz in circles above the burial places. Emo had liked what they showed him. Big mortar shells that blew tanks and big trucks to pieces. Jagged steel flakes that exploded from the grenades. The way the flamethrower melted a rifle into a shapeless lump. He understood them right away. He knew what they wanted. He was the best, they told him. Some men didn't like to feel the quiver of the man they were killing. Some men got sick when they smelled the blood. But he was the best. He was one of them. The best. United States Army. Something was different about the beer this time. It swelled through his blood and made all the muscles loose and warm, but it was also loosening something deeper inside, which clenched the anger and held it in place. He could feel it happening. Like 2 days of snow piled deep on the branches of a big pine tree the morning of the second day, when the sun came out and crystal by crystal penetrated the snow, melting it away from the pine needles until a single gust of mountain wind, and suddenly all the snow came tumbling down. Emo played with the teeth. He pretended to put them in his own mouth at funny angles. Everyone was laughing. The teeth sucked up the light,